From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Uprisings continue in several cities in Iraq, but will they succeed in overthrowing Saddam Hussein? On this edition of Fresh Air, we discuss the rebellions with Middle East expert Charles Tripp of the University of London. Also today, Patrick Seal tells us about some of the opposition leaders who hope to replace Saddam Hussein. Journalist James Ridgway looks at the extremist fringe of American politics. His new book and documentary film are about the racist, anti-Semitic, ultra-right-wing fringe. And rock historian Ed Ward plays some music by some of the first integrated groups in rock and roll. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Refugees fleeing the southern Iraqi city of Basra say that the rebellion there is about to be crushed by the Iraqi army. It's reported that troops loyal to Saddam Hussein totally surround the city. The BBC's Andy Tai has more.
The trickle of refugees crossing into Kuwait is now one of the chief sources of information about what's happening in Basra. Many of the people arriving at the border have traveled on foot, though, and they're still recounting what went on at the weekend when the uprising began and official buildings were attacked. People who left more recently say although resistance fighters are still active inside Basra, the Iraqi army has totally encircled the city. Brock Matthews, an Englishman who was arrested at his home in Kuwait last month and taken to Basra, was released from prison on Saturday by the rebels. He managed to get out of the city yesterday and says, from his experience, the Iraqi army is suppressing the uprising ruthlessly.
The BBC's Andy Tai reporting. More American journalists have been reported missing in southern Iraq. The latest to be reported missing include a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, two for Time magazine, and two photographers working for U.S. News and World Report. NPR's Neil Conan is among the more than 30 journalists who are still unaccounted for. Iraqi dissident groups in Iran have said that the reporters are now in the hands of Iraqi government forces in or near Basra. The journalists entered Iraqi territory on Sunday and Monday in an effort to investigate reports of fighting between dissidents and the Iraqi army. The Vatican was the site of the first international meeting dealing with the post-war situation in the Gulf. Pope John Paul convened Catholic leaders from all over the world for the two-day session. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports from Rome.
Pope John Paul called for an intense search for the beginning of an immediate solution to the Palestinian problem. He said this is a major requirement for achieving a just and lasting peace in the Middle East. The Pope made the speech in his general weekly audience before thousands of pilgrims. He was flanked by seven Middle East Catholic patriarchs and bishops from the United States and European countries directly involved in the Gulf War. The Pope had convened the patriarchs and bishops for a conference to discuss what the Catholic Church can do to counter the long-standing rancor, religious antagonisms, and cultural divisions of the Middle East region. The Pope said the injustice of which the Palestinians are victim requires a commitment from all to reach an immediate solution and recognition of the Palestinian people. In Rome, this is Sylvia Poggioli.
Stock prices stayed essentially the same today after fluctuating sharply. After briefly rising above 3,000, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell back to within a quarter of a point of where it was yesterday, closing at 2,973.27. Advances edged declines in heavy trading of 262 million shares. This is NPR News. An Iraqi military spokesman said today that the Iraqi army will disband 10 divisions that were formed after the August invasion of Kuwait. The announcement, read on Iraqi radio, didn't say when the demobilization would take effect or how many men were involved. An Iraqi division is said to contain about 10,000 men. Both Republican and Democratic lawmakers demanded today that Air Force officials and defense contractors explain why the B-1 bomber, after years of development and billions of dollars, is still basically useless. A House panel was especially interested in finding out why the B-1 was not used in the Persian Gulf War. NPR's Vicki O'Hara reports.
Committee Chairman John Conyers, Democrat of Michigan, asked that question directly. Major General Richard Hawley, Director of Operations Headquarters of the U.S. Air Force, replied that the bombing mission in the Persian Gulf was better suited to the aging B-52. He said that the B-1, which was supposed to be the transitional aircraft between the B-52 and the futuristic stealth bomber, has both nuclear and conventional weapons capability, but he said it's ideally suited to delivering nuclear weapons. Pilots speak highly of the B-1, but the aircraft has had nothing but problems since coming into service in 1986. The House committee is investigating the aircraft's inability to de-ice and to jam enemy radar. Lawmakers say today's hearing was just the beginning. In Washington, this is Vicki O'Hara.
The United Nations Human Rights Commission voted today to investigate human rights abuses in Iraq and to condemn the Iraqi army for human rights violations in Kuwait. The commission voted to appoint a special investigator to study abuses in Iraq, with particular attention to the government's use of chemical weapons against the Kurdish population. It was the first time the UN has agreed to an investigation of the allegations against Iraq. Human rights activists charged that the UN was reluctant to antagonize Iraq while it was rich and politically powerful. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Shiite uprising against Saddam Hussein is continuing in southern Iraq, although the Republican Guard is reported to be crushing the opposition in some cities. Kurds in the north are also rebelling against Saddam. For some background and analysis, we called Charles Tripp, who has written about Saddam's inner circle and also about the Iran-Iraq war. He teaches at London University's School of Oriental and African Studies. Recently, President Bush called on the Iraqi people to overthrow Saddam. I asked Tripp if he thought these rebellions were what the president had in mind.
Well, I begin to wonder. I think that the allies and the powers outside Iraq generally have hoped that somebody would overthrow Saddam Hussein and preferably as well the whole regime that Saddam Hussein has constructed for himself in Iraq. How that was going to come about, I think they were always a bit puzzled. And I think that that's been one of the problems since the beginning of the crisis, that there was a hope that either a fear of an uprising in Iraq or an overthrow would cause Saddam Hussein to moderate his policies, or it would actually happen and the government would change. But it seems that in all sides there's been a certain powerlessness. So whether there was a vision of a mass popular uprising or whether there was a vision of a quiet palace coup d'etat and the assassination of Saddam Hussein, it's difficult to tell. But certainly one could say that the present uprising in both the south and the north of Iraq corresponds to what people might wish, but of course I'm doubtful whether it will actually turn into the overthrow of Saddam Hussein.
Why don't you think it will?
Well, I think that one of the problems is demonstrated by the nature of the revolt. The revolt's very understandable in the sense that both in the southern cities, which are largely Shi'i, the people have been much affected by the demoralization of the war, by memories of oppression, and by the belief that with the chaos of the defeat, the surveillance and the intelligence services have been disintegrated, and so their fear has been lifted momentarily. And this has allowed them to go out on the streets to demonstrate, to seize weapons, and to try and do something about it. But their problem is that they are now sitting ducks for the return of Saddam Hussein, as it were. That is, for the return of the Republican Guard in force into these cities.
Is this the first time that the Guard's been called on to contain uprisings within the country?
Oh, no, far from it. I think that during the Iran-Iraq war, units of the Republican Guard, because they are the most politically trusted, were used to carry out some of the most repugnant operations in Kurdistan against the Kurdish civilian areas and the guerrillas that thrived in them. And after the ending of the Iran-Iraq war, again, the Republican Guard units were used in the marshes of southern Iraq to chase and hunt down and usually kill large numbers of Iraqi army deserters who were lurking in the marshes of southern Iraq and who were picked off after the end of the Iran-Iraq War during 1989.
You know, I can't imagine why the Republican Guards would still be loyal to Saddam Hussein after what he exposed them to. I mean, so many of the Republican Guards were just slaughtered. They had no air cover.
Well, I think that one has to make a distinction. We've been talking about the Republican Guard in general over the last few months in the West, but the Republican Guard, as we see it now, is a product of the disasters of 1986. Up to that time, the Republican Guard was largely just two divisions, And those two divisions were almost exclusively recruited from the home territory of Saddam Hussein around Tikrit and from his own tribesmen of the Abu Nasser. And what happened during 1986 was that they got decimated in battles with the Iranians, and the Republican Guard thereafter was built up enormously into about 10 divisions. So what one has seen is a Republican Guard which is much more like the normal part of the Iraqi army, and a heart or a core of the Republican Guard which remains fiercely loyal to Saddam Hussein. Those units, the people who are fiercely loyal to Saddam Hussein, were not touched in the battle for Kuwait. They were retained around Baghdad.
To protect Saddam.
To protect Saddam, and precisely to be used in the kind of eventuality that they're now being used in, that is to mop up any chaos that might result from military defeat and any mutinous military units that might emerge in Iraq.
What about the rest of the Republican Guard, the part that might not be as loyal to Saddam Hussein? Do you think there's any chance that they would turn against him?
It's always a possibility, but I'm not sure that they would in these circumstances. And here I think one has to go back to the fact that the kind of action which they're now being called upon to take against the southern Shi'i towns and possibly also against the northern Kurdish rebels is very much part of the action for which the Republican Guard has been largely constructed. That is, even if not directly loyal to Saddam Hussein's clan, they are nevertheless seen in many ways to be hostile to the Shi'i, to the Kurds. And in those circumstances, it's unlikely that Republican Guard will turn against Saddam Hussein, although eventually, once this problem is solved, as it were, in their own way, there might well be a temptation for senior military officers, whether in the Republican Guard or not, to turn against Saddam Hussein.
Two of the populations involved in the current uprisings are the Kurds and the Shiites. They both want to overthrow Saddam Hussein, but do they have conflicting agendas? In other words, if they actually succeeded in overthrowing Saddam, would they want different things?
Well, it's difficult to tell at this stage. I think one of the things that's become noticeable in the last year is the fact that the major political parties of the Kurds, represented by the Iraqi Kurdish Front, and the major political parties of the Shi'i groups, which is called in the umbrella organization the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, these groups have come together, and what they have done is to sign a joint program pledging that they will both support the overthrow of Saddam Hussein and his replacement by a democratic, open political system. And in many ways, this is their last hope, because what they have tried up to now, fighting each other, fighting the regime, proposing their own ideologies, if you like, has been very unsuccessful. So their hope is that at least some form of open democratic system can be established in Iraq, which will allow them to express their views and then possibly pursue interests which are not by any means identical. Unfortunately, there is a large element of the utopian in that, I think.
Do you think that Saddam Hussein was so badly humiliated, not only in losing the war, but in how badly he lost the war, that it would give incentive to his inner circle to overthrow him?
Oh, I think that's a very important part of the mistrust that is probably now beginning to do its corrosive damage in the inner circle of the Iraqi regime, that it was very important for Saddam Hussein in the invasion of Kuwait, in the refusal to withdraw except under his own conditions, to be seen to have retained his face, his honor. And what the group he was appealing to in doing that was largely his inner circle. He didn't really care about the larger Iraqi public, the larger Arab world. What he wanted to try and do was to impress these people with his competence, at least his ability to pull it off, as it were, to gain an apparent advantage for Iraq. Well, clearly, over the last 6 weeks or so, the results of this adventure for Iraq and for the Iraqi elite has been disastrous. And in those circumstances, they will begin to wonder whether Saddam Hussein can, first of all, continue to exert the kinds of control which he has hitherto exerted in Iraq, which has allowed them all to do quite well out of him. And secondly, whether he's capable of ruling them, of looking after their own interests. That is he going to lead them into another adventure, another disaster in the near future? And in order to prevent that from happening, it's a very strong possibility that one of their number will try and get rid of him.
There have been reports that Saddam Hussein's oldest son was killed in southern Iraq. Do you think that these popular uprisings will scare Saddam's inner circle and inspire them to get rid of him to protect themselves?
No, I have a feeling that they might work in the opposite direction, in the sense that the uprisings both in the south and in the north, by the Shi'i in the south and by the Kurds in the north, are so identifiable by the inner circle of Saddam Hussein, who are largely Sunni Arab, as revolts of the Shi'i and of the Kurds. And in many ways, they have no interest in seeing these sorts of revolts succeed. Whatever doubts they may have about Saddam Hussein's leadership, and quite clearly, after the events of the last few months, they are beginning to doubt, obviously, the competence of Saddam Hussein. But in many ways, one can see that the effect of these kinds of revolts on this inner circle would be to tighten the inner circle around Saddam Hussein.
That's interesting. So it might have the opposite effect that it's intended to.
Yes, I think that is quite a strong possibility.
You think that it's likely Saddam Hussein will stay in power a while longer?
Well, I have a feeling that if Saddam Hussein can weather the next 3 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks, then he will be able to stay in power, really, until he's challenged from within not only the inner circle, but perhaps the slightly larger circle of disgruntled army officers. And that, I think, is unlikely to happen before the next 6 months. So if he can survive the next 2 or 3 weeks, there's a strong possibility, barring assassination, that he can survive at least for the next 6 months or so. I think he has real problems, actually, in trying to survive beyond a year, simply because the economy of Iraq is completely finished. There is no way in which he can marshal the resources which have hitherto kept most of the people on his side. And so a bankrupt regime, an unsuccessful regime, is not one which many people in Iraq want to associate themselves with, and they may well turn against him.
One last question. Saddam Hussein has issued an amnesty for Iraqi deserters. If you were a deserter in the Iraqi army, would you trust him?
No. I think that there have been numerous amnesties before, and the danger has been that people have given themselves in and have simply been shot. But largely, this has depended upon who you are. There was an amnesty for Kurds, and many Kurds were killed when they turned themselves in. There was an amnesty for the largely Shi'i deserters living in the south of the marshes, and again, many of them were killed when they turned themselves in, so they preferred to stay in the marshes, although eventually the Iraqi Republican Guard went and hunted them down in the marshes over the last couple of years. But if you are a deserter who comes from a Sunni Arab background, who represents no sort of threat in terms of alliance with the Kurds or the Shi'i, there's a strong possibility that you would really be able to get away with it. But it's not necessarily something that people are going to risk their lives for.
Charles Tripp, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Charles Tripp is co-author of Iran and Iraq at War and teaches at London University's School of Oriental and African Studies. Coming up, who's waiting in the wings to take over if and when Saddam Hussein falls? This is Fresh Air. The rebelling Kurds and Shiites aren't the only ones who want to overthrow Saddam Hussein. To get an idea of who the Iraqi opposition leaders are, we called Patrick Seal. Seal is a former foreign correspondent for Reuters and The Observer, and is the author of several books on the Middle East, including a recent biography of Syrian President Hafez al-Assad. Seal says there's a variety of opposition leaders ready to step in if Saddam is overthrown.
Almost every country surrounding Iraq has a candidate for power in that country. The Iranians have a gentleman called Mohammed Bakr al-Hakim, who comes from a distinguished religious family in Iraq and who has had and enjoyed Iranian protection for some years now under the cover of something called the Supreme Assembly for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. Now, this is an Iranian-backed organization, and for that reason, it doesn't necessarily have a great deal of support inside the country. The Syrians, in turn, have a motley collection of opposition groups under a former Iraqi chief of staff called General Hassan al-Naqib, who fell out of favor in Iraq, was posted as ambassador first to Madrid and then to Stockholm, and then defected, turned up in Damascus, where the Syrians for some years now have been grooming him as a potential successor. Saudi Arabia, in turn, has a number of exiled Iraqi politicians. But it's quite hard, I would say, for any of these neighboring states to impose their own man. Indeed, I would suppose, and this is only a guess, that if Iran, which is one of the countries with direct leverage inside Iraq because of the large Shiite community, if it fails to establish an Islamic government in Baghdad, and it doesn't for the moment look as if it will succeed, then it may well prefer to see Saddam Hussein himself survive, because after all, he's now very weak. They've done business with him. He's made all the concessions which they wanted him to make. He's to some extent dependent on them. So he, in effect, may be their alternative candidate.
All the different opposition candidates who you've mentioned, are these people, are any of these people involved in what we might call pro-democracy groups?
Well, you know, they all proclaim democratic intentions. But I think some of these intentions have to be taken with a pinch of salt. They are all, as I say, supported from outside. The regimes that support them are not noteworthy for their working democracies. And but the fact remains that Iraq is a mosaic of different communities. This is one of the problems right from the beginning of the state, the foundation of it by the British in the early 1920s. The British, as you know, drew together the Kurds, the Sunni Arabs, the Shiite Arabs, and other groups, Christians and Turkmens. Now, these groups had no tradition of living together except under the Ottoman Empire. And it was quite difficult for the rulers in Baghdad to weld them into a cohesive society. Indeed, one may even say that Saddam Hussein has been more successful than many. But now that his regime has been gravely weakened, these sort of centrifugal tendencies inside Iraq are expected to reemerge. And it'll be quite hard, I think, to keep the country together.
The fighting that's taking place now in the south of Iraq, it's a largely Shiite uprising. Do you think that those Shiites are backed by Iran? Or do you think that they're operating independently?
Yes, I would say they were. They certainly have the support of Iran. But Iran will be rather cautious, I would say, in giving direct support. For one thing, direct support from an outside state would weaken the internal opposition rather than strengthen it, because people would say these people are not true patriots. They're actually only agents of a foreign power. And this was the part of the trouble which I think the Iranians had in their support for some dissident groups throughout the Iraq-Iran war. But of course, the Iranians, you may recall at the beginning of the Iraq-Iran war, in the 1980 or thereabouts, the Iraqis expelled to Iran large numbers of Shias who they suspected of disloyalty. Now, the Iranians have mobilized some of these people into a sort of guerrilla army. And they may well be used. Some of them may already be engaged. But I would say that Iran itself will hesitate before showing its hand. It may call for Saddam's overthrow. It may give some discreet support. But it should still want to keep open a line of communication to Saddam himself.
Do you think we're going to see any infighting between the victors of the war, between the Saudis and the Syrians and the English and the Americans, over whose interests are represented in a new government after Saddam Hussein, whose man gets installed?
Well, the war has created grave dislocations in the region. In the Gulf area, it's created a vacuum of power, because Iraq, whether one likes it or dislikes it, is the major Arab power in the Gulf region. If you destroy Iraq, you immediately hand hegemony in the region to Iran, counterweighted only or counterbalanced by Saudi Arabia. But Saudi Arabia is a very small country in terms of population. It may look big on the map, but it only has a population of perhaps 8 million or so, whereas Iran has a population of 55 million. And Iran sprawls across the whole of the northern shore of the Gulf. So naturally, the destruction of Iraq has robbed the Arabs of a counterweight to Iran. So this into this vacuum, and this vacuum explains now, I think, this struggle over the question of security in the Gulf. As you know, at least two models have been advanced. One is Iran's model. What Iran is saying is that the security of the countries in the Gulf has to be the responsibility of the countries of the Gulf itself. And, of course, it counts itself as one of the principal countries. The second model could be described as Egypt's model. What Egypt is saying, with some support from the Western powers, is that it should produce or provide the military underpinning for the security of Saudi Arabia and its immediate neighbors, its little Gulf states. And as you may have seen today in Damascus, there was a declaration issued by 8 countries, that is to say the 6 member countries of the Gulf Cooperation Council, plus Egypt, plus Syria, in which they set up a sort of Arab peacekeeping force. So this is, as it were, the Egyptian model, or Egyptian-Syrian model, which appears to be triumphing as opposed to the Iranian model. Now, this is going to cause some strains between Syria and Iran, who are, after all, strategic allies. The Syrians appear to have, as it were, chosen the coalition side as opposed to Iran's side. So this I think, is possibly a source for some tension in the future.
What are you most going to be looking out for in the next few weeks now that the war is over?
Well, what everybody is looking out for is American policy. What will James Baker bring to the region this coming week? Now, everybody during the heat of the recent battle was hoping that the United States would apply the same sort of energy to resolving some of the underlying problems of this region, and notably the Palestine problem, as it had shown in the conduct of the war. But one has to say that in the last few days, as the war has receded, skepticism has gained ground. And certainly, if one considers the balance of power on the ground, Israel very, very strong, and the Arabs very weak, and the Palestinians discredited, or at least their leadership discredited, it seems hard to believe that the United States will pursue a settlement of this problem. On the other hand, if it doesn't do so, its moral position in the region will be greatly eroded. There'll be many people seeking revenge for the destruction of Iraq and the vast casualties caused there. And indeed, one could well expect a renewed cycle of violence and radicalism. And so it's very much, I would suppose, in America's interest to demonstrate that a wise superpower knows how to strike an even-handed deal in what is a region at present very unbalanced.
Patrick Seale, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay.
Patrick Seale's latest book is a biography of Syrian President Hafez al-Assad. He spoke to us from his home in London. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Journalist James Ridgway has been looking into some of the most hate-filled people in America, members of the American Nazi Party, the Ku Klux Klan, and other white supremacist groups. He's documented his findings in a new book and a new film. Coming up, James Ridgway on the racist, anti-Semitic fringes of American politics. And our rock historian, Ed Ward, examines one way early rock and roll brought blacks and whites together, doo-wop. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush is expected to tell a joint session of Congress tonight that the time has come to put an end to the Arab-Israeli conflict. While speaking of the end of the Persian Gulf War, Mr. Bush is expected to note that a U.S. commitment to peace in the Middle East does not end with the liberation of Kuwait. There's no definite word yet on the whereabouts of more than 30 Western journalists reported missing in southern Iraq. Included in the group is NPR's Neil Conan and several other American reporters. The journalists were investigating reports of unrest in southern Iraq and were apparently detained, though it is not yet clear by whom. NPR's Tom Gelton reports from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia.
The missing journalists all headed from Kuwait or Saudi Arabia north into Iraq on Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. They apparently passed Allied military checkpoints and went on into parts of Iraq still under Iraqi control. Other journalists who tried to do the same thing were stopped by armed Iraqi soldiers and told to turn back. A photographer for the Sigma News Agency says two carloads of heavily armed Iraqis tried to intercept his vehicle and aimed their rifles at him, evidently preparing to fire. He managed to return safely to the Allied occupied area. Southern Iraq has been the scene of fighting over the past few days between troops loyal to Saddam Hussein and dissident groups. One Iraqi opposition group reported from Iran today that the journalists were detained by the Iraqi army, though another opposition spokesman said at least some of the journalists were being sheltered by dissidents in Basra. U.S. officials say they are in contact with the Iraqi government and doing all they can to secure the safe return of the journalists. I'm Tom Gelton in Riyadh.
Britain's Ministry of Defense has announced that 32 Iraqis detained in Britain as prisoners of war have now been released. The men were held on grounds that they were a threat to national security. Jonathan Dyer reports from London.
All 32 men are students who, until their arrest at the start of the war, had been on educational courses in Britain, some financed by the Iraqi military, although it's thought that most of them were not serving members of the armed forces. On Tuesday, the Ministry of Defence said the men would not be freed until a formal and permanent ceasefire had been agreed in the Gulf. But announcing the POW's release less than 24 hours later, the ministry said that all would be allowed to stay in Britain. The Iraqis say their detention was wrong.
Being here as a student, I never thought I would be ended one day as POW. As far as I know, that POW is caught in the battlefields and not in the universities.
The men's detention had been criticised by civil rights groups. A further 33 Middle East civilians are still being held under threat of deportation. For National Public Radio, I'm Jonathan Dyer in London.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up less than a point to close at 2,973.27, on volume of some 262 million shares. This is NPR News. U.S. military officials say that it may take up to 6 months to clear Kuwait of most landmines. Marine Brigadier General Richard Neal says even after that, some unexploded mines may still be discovered. Occupying Iraqi forces laid an estimated 500,000 mines in Kuwait. Neal also says that minesweeping operations are underway to open Kuwait harbors so that supplies can be brought in for Allied forces. Investigators have examined nearly 50,000 packages of Sudafed cold capsules in Washington state, but no new tampered products have been found. Meanwhile, the Food and Drug Administration says that it may have a theory that explains how a person could have left cyanide-laced medicine on drugstore shelves in different locations. Martin McGee of member station KUOW has more.
It may not be a big lead, investigators say, but it could be significant. The FDA says all six tampered packages discovered so far were found at stores near main freeway interchanges, One scenario under investigation is of a person driving the freeways, dropping off poisoned capsules at random stores along the way. The FBI says it is questioning a number of people, but won't discuss any possible suspects. Two people in the Tacoma Olympia area have died, and one fell into a coma after taking cyanide-laced Sudafed 12-hour cold capsules last month. Two other tampered packages were turned in by consumers, and one was found yesterday by investigators sifting through recalled packages. In Seattle, the King County Medical Examiner says he has tested the tissue of 22 people who died mysteriously this year, but none have shown signs of cyanide poisoning. For National Public Radio, I'm Martin Munguia in Seattle.
New cases of cholera have now been reported in Ecuador after claiming more than 250 lives in Peru. According to officials, all cases reported thus far have been in a province which borders on Peru. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. A lot of people dismiss the American Nazi Party, the Ku Klux Klan, and the skinheads as the lunatic fringe. Reporter James Ridgway started taking seriously the racist far right in 1984 when he was reporting on the presidential campaign for the Village Voice. He was traveling in the Midwest during the height of the farm crisis. He found people were desperate and many were turning to extremist hate groups for answers. Ridgway continued to research the history and culture of the racist far right. He's written a new book and produced a film, both called Blood in the Face. He told me why he thought these racist groups caught on in the Midwest.
The people who were making sense, the people who sort of brought everybody, you know, up, got them going, were these people from the far right who were, you know, arguing that you had to fight the foreclosures, that there was really a conspiracy behind them, that it was an international Jewish, you know, banking conspiracy. They had hotlines. There were secret organizations, kind of mysterious organizations, with names like the Posse Comitatus. And what these groups did was they offered an analysis. They offered a theory of what was happening. Now, I don't, you know, share that theory, but for a time, it was a captivating thing. And it was totally ignored by everybody. And so this far right, it seemed to me, had a real impact on that part of the country. And of course, you know, it's a real wide swath because it's not just the Middle West. It was also in the far west and in the south. And that's what got me interested in it. And I really came to think and do think that all these ideas that influence mainstream American politics oftentimes, you know, percolate from, you know, the further shores.
David Duke of the Ku Klux Klan was elected to the Louisiana State Legislature in 1990. Do you see Duke as representing the cutting edge of a new style in racist leadership?
Well, I think, you know, Duke may be gone, you know, relatively soon from the political scene. I don't know. But I do think so, yeah. I think that Duke's ability to get as many votes as he did, I mean, it was like 600,000, you know, 40% of the white vote, 40% of the vote overall and two-thirds of the white vote and a higher percentage of young white men is really impressive in terms of politics. And I think that those who argue that David Duke is just a populist and this was just some sort of a populist campaign, I really don't have it correct. I mean, I think this was not a populist campaign. I mean, Duke made a great point of running on what he thinks, and I think everybody would have to admit if they looked at it, was a conservative Republican. And he liked to talk about Reagan. I mean, Reagan wouldn't share his views, but a conservative Republican platform. And it was with a racial spear point. I mean, it was cloaked in racialism.
He was actually thrown out of the Klan for selling Klan mailing lists for, what, $35,000 or something. Did they ever try to use that against him in his campaign? I mean, you know, who, discredited by the Ku Klux Klan. I don't know what the outcome
would
have been of that.
No, that was sort of like one of those intramural fights, I guess,
right,
in different Klan groups. And of course, David Duke is, you know, the Klan is historically anti-Catholic, but David Duke takes great pride in his reform efforts in the Klan, and his Klan in Louisiana was largely Catholic. So he says.
There's something else about David Duke that other people might know. I certainly didn't. I learned it in your book, was that he wrote a couple of books under pseudonyms. He wrote a manual called How to Get a Man under a female pseudonym that included, like, sex tips on getting your man. He wrote a street fighting manual for blacks under a pseudonym. This kind of sounds bizarre.
Well, it's all part of the sort of like guerrilla warfare. It's kind of this covert, this enthralling CIA daring do, you know, stuff where you pretend to be one thing when you're actually something else. And
did he have an agenda for writing these books? I mean, do you think it was a psychological agenda or a political one?
I don't know. You know, it might have been a psychological one. It's really hard to know. I mean, it's sort of like, it's loopy, you know? I don't know where it came from.
Right. I really am very interested in the fact that he had plastic surgery. Do you think it was to make him look even more Aryan or something?
Well, I think it was probably to make him look good on television.
Right.
And also he said, he'd had either a broken nose or a jaw or something, and he just wanted to get it fixed, and he didn't see why people should be so upset about it. He was just like everybody else, which is probably partly true.
When you were interviewing people from the extremist groups, what kind of approach did you take? And when you were hanging around with them, too, I mean, did you try not to let them know that you were passing judgment on them and to just be very neutral?
Well, no. I have a particular way of doing things, and I'm extremely interested in people. I'm interested in why they think the way they think, and where I'm interested in their histories and where they came from, and why they operate the way they do. And I wasn't interested in passing any judgment on the Ku Klux Klan. I mean, I'm not a member of the Ku Klux Klan. I don't believe in the ideas and theories and so on of the Klan or the far right. But I am very interested in finding out where these ideas come from, and like why they think the way they think. And I think that you have to sort of get people going and give them a chance to explain, you know, and themselves, and do it over and over again. Take a long time, as long as it takes. And you know, it gets pretty boring after a while. But I mean, you sort of then, after you do this for several hours, you get a kind of a feel for where all this is coming from.
I want to play a clip from your movie, and this is actually an archival clip with George Lincoln Rockwell, the founder of the American Nazi Party. This appears to be a news interview with him, and he's fielding questions about why he believes what he believes.
Do you consider yourself the second Führer?
I don't even use the word Führer. I'm not a German. I'm an American, as you're a Canadian. I consider myself, in terms of Bolshevism, I would be the Lenin to Marx. And in terms of Christianity, I'm the St. Paul to Hitler's Christ. In other words, I am the spreader, the world spreader of a doctrine which Hitler originated, and it was crucified, dead and buried, and it is now rising.
Are you a Superman, Commander?
I'm not a Superman, no. There's probably people here could whip me. I think that all I am is the offspring of millions of years of evolution which has produced white Christian civilization. I am one example of it, not a Superman. I think that compared to an Aborigine in Africa who eats his grandmother, and they're still eating people over there, I think I am, and so are you. We're all Supermen compared to those cruds.
Commander, how do you feel about the allegations that the American Nazi Party has strong homosexual tendencies?
I will say this. In my organization, I have men who were homosexuals. They were sucked into that filth, just like drunkards or dope fiends. And I have been able to rescue them. And I'm not a bit ashamed of that. I'll stand shoulder to shoulder with anyone on any day. The only thing I will not tolerate is a homosexual who is a homosexual.
This is one of your enemies?
That's one of the biggest enemies. I'd rather gas queers than anybody else.
Well, that's pretty chilling.
You know, the thing about Rockwell that's really interesting is that, you know, he never was very much of anything in the far right. I mean, he didn't really cut much of a path. But in death, I mean, as time has gone on, he's become really this kind of like hero or this who people talk about far more than I think they ever did when he was alive.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James Ridgway, and he writes a regular feature in the Village Voice called The Moving Target. He's the author of the new book and co-filmmaker of a new movie called Blood in the Face, which is about the extremist racist groups in America. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist James Ridgway is my guest, and he's written a new book that's the companion to a new movie called Blood in the Face, about the extremist, racist, right-wing groups in America. Let's try to get deeper into the thinking of these racist groups. In hating Jews and in hating blacks and hating Asians in America and gays, are there different things that they blame each group for? Is there like a different reason to hate blacks than there is to hate Jews when you get deep into the thinking of the people who belong to these groups?
Well, currently, I mean, the major preoccupation, I think, on the far right is Jews. And blacks have sort of subsided. But what happens is the people whom, if there's violence, I mean, the people who bear the violence are black people, and poor black people. They always bear the violence. But the Jews provide more of they give you more to work on in terms of your theories, I guess. I mean, you can theoretically say that the Jews have been, the myths about the Jew as a demon, you know, have been going on for so many centuries that, you know, you can work on that a little harder. So it's basically about the Jewish conspiracy and about money, international banking, which does reverberate, you know, to a lot of people, especially in hard times.
When you look at the extremist racist groups now, what do you see as the greatest threat? Which groups or which individuals or is it just the mass of it that worries you the most?
I think the thing that's, if you want to call it a threat, are the ideas. I don't think that there's any number of these people that are going to rise up and, you know, go and kill people. I mean, there are real conspiracies of attempt to, like there are conspiracies of people who were members of the Aryan Nations who attempted to bomb a gay nightclub in Seattle. Those are real criminal acts. There are things like that. There are those kinds of conspiracies. But, I mean, the real thing here are the ideas and what happens to the ideas and the relationship of the mainstream politics to some of these fringe groups. And, I mean, the David Duke thing is a very clear and, you know, obvious and probably sort of woebegone example of all this. But it's sort of the beast within everyone. I mean, none of us are going to care to admit to this. I mean, we just don't care to admit to it, that we're going to do things like this. And the way it works is that you have a Klan cross-burning, and everybody from television is now welcome, comes in. It's not just 200 people in a back lot somewhere in the South, you know, in the misty woods at night. All the television cameras are there. You cross burns and march around, do stuff, and you show it on television. People say, well, I'm not that. That's certainly, I wouldn't do that. But and you can attack the Klan, but the ideas will linger in your mind.
Is that an argument for not paying attention to them, for not giving them a lot of press?
No,
coverage?
I think the way to deal with the far right, I think the way that, you know, a liberal person or American society should deal with all politics is to pay attention to all of it, all the time. And I think that the way in which the far right works out in American culture is that you have to learn about it. You can't pretend it's a paranoid fringe. If you want to keep pretending, like most American historians, you know, don't pretend but argue, that this is a paranoid fringe and has no meaning in American society, you'll do so at your peril. I guarantee, in my opinion, you'll do so at your peril, because something will happen that will come from this so-called paranoid fringe, and then you can reinvent it and you can say it's a paranoid fringe. But I don't think it is a paranoid fringe. I think it's a substantial, important, central part of American culture. And that's probably what differentiates someone like myself from most of the other people who write and discuss this subject.
James Ridgway is a columnist for The Village Voice. His new book on the rise of white supremacist groups is called Blood in the Face. He produced a new documentary of the same name. It's showing at the Film Forum in New York. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward plays some music that brought black and white teenagers together in the 50s, music like this.
Nah, not that thing again. Sing Melancholy Baby.
All right, we will.
Melancholy Baby.
Come to me, my melancholy baby. Come to me.
This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Terry. We continue to catch up on stories we've underreported during these past couple of months of war. Today, some domestic issues that we missed while we were watching the Gulf.
Robert, is there any news on NPR's Neil Conan and the other missing journalists in Iraq?
No real news. We've heard some claims that the missing journalists were being held by Iraqi opposition forces, but no way to confirm that. We have no information about Neil or about Chris Hedges of the New York Times, whom he set off with. So we just continue to wait and do our best to find out where he is.
Thanks, Robert. You can hear the news on All Things Considered coming up from National Public Radio. During the 1950s, rock and roll brought black and white kids together, not just in the audiences at shows, but also up on stage. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says this integration even happened in the most black-defined genre, harmony group singing, which had its roots in churches the average white teenager would never have gone to.
Harmony group singing is irresistible to people who like to sing, so it was probably inevitable that in 1955, the Dell Vikings, five guys in the Air Force who were stationed in Pittsburgh, got together to see what they'd sound like. As it turned out, they sounded pretty good.
Dun, dun, dun.
Tiny local label, Phoebe, released Come Go With Me in Pittsburgh, a city known for its good taste in harmony records, ate it up. Soon, the record's classic status was nationwide news because Phoebe had leased it to Dot and it became one of the biggest hits of 1957. The Dell Vikings saw visions of stardom and it was their downfall. As soon as they got out of the Air Force, the group split in two. One of the black guys, Cripps Johnson, hired four more guys and recorded for Dot. The others recorded for Mercury, but never really had the feel again. The next big integrated group came from New York's Chinatown and from Brooklyn, and they were at first integrated not only racially, but sexually. The Crests had started in the Alfred Smith housing projects in Chinatown and weren't really serious until Johnny Mastrangelo showed up from Brooklyn, where he'd been singing with another integrated group. Rehearsing together at the Brooklyn Bridge subway station, they attracted a woman's attention. She told them they were good and handed them her husband's business card, Al Brown, orchestra leader. Brown seconded his wife's opinion and got them some recording sessions, but nothing really happened until the Crests signed with Co-Ed Records in 1958. Little Angel didn't do much, and it sounded like they were feeling their way towards a sound. They'd had to let their female member go because she wasn't allowed to travel with them, and they were trying to fill that gap. Throughout 1958, they kept at it, and in November, they hit it. The song was originally called 21 Candles, by the way. Changing the title probably saved it from obscurity. 16 Candles, though, established the Crest sound, and it was Johnny Maestro, as he was now called, up front. More and more, the group's management downplayed the three black members, and you could hardly hear them after a while.
The angels listened in,
listen.
When they heard me pray. Send the one I'm thinking of my time.
studio singers had been added, and soon Johnny Maestro would become a standard early 60s pretty boy singer. The Marcells were certainly the weirdest of these integrated groups, coming as they did at the end of harmony singing's popularity. But in 1961, people were already feeling nostalgic for the classics of that genre, and there was no denying the Marcells' gimmick. Again, an integrated group from Pittsburgh had blasted its way onto the charts thanks to influential New York DJ Murray the K. Kaufman, who had played an advanced tape of Blue Moon on his show. The record climbed the charts faster than any record ever had before, and the Marcells were on their way. On their way out. The two white guys had been muscled out of the group by the end of the year. But the Marcells managed to record some good stuff right into 1962, including this critique of consumerism.
My baby said she'd marry me, but there was just one thing.
What?
I had to go and buy her a great big diamond ring. I didn't have no money, I didn't know where to go, until I heard that fella say on the radio.
I get, I get over to Friendly Loan. Hurry over to Friendly Loan. All you have to do is sign on the dotted line, and the money is there, and the treatment is fine at Friendly Loan.
But rock and roll had changed, and the Marcells probably wouldn't have been too successful for much longer, no matter what their racial makeup. Still, like the Del Vikings and the Crests, they'd started something. Now, integration was moving off the stage and into real life.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle.
Well, 6 nights a week.
Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shurrock are our production assistants. Fresh Air's theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and is performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the Great Black Migration. Between the 1940s and 60s, more than 5 million blacks left the Deep South and came north. Journalist Nicholas Lehman tells us the reasons for the migration and how it changed the country. It's the subject of his new book, The Promised Land. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.